Okay, so I don't need an introduction. This is the fourth and final lecture in this series, and again, I want to thank Professor Changeux, Professor Corval for inviting me. We have had a marvelous time here in Paris, and in this final lecture, I'm going to talk about a totally different topic than anything I've talked about before. And it has to do with the problem of starvation and the essential role of two hormones, ghrelin and growth hormone. Let me just start by talking about starvation. In the United States now, all the attention is on obesity and the problem of overweight and diabetes. But from a world perspective, the real problem is the opposite. It's starvation. 15% of the world's population is thought to be starving at any time. And 50% of all deaths in children less than 5 years of age, more than 6 million deaths per year, are caused by starvation. And the World Health Organization has said that hunger is the single greatest threat to the world's public health. Now, every animal species experiences starvation at one time or another. In humans, it has been particularly severe. For example, in France, in the years 1315 to 1317, there was a terrible famine caused by poor harvests, and it is estimated that one out of every four French people died during that time. And in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, in a 300-year period, there were 42 documented periods of famine in France alone. So think of what evolutionary pressure that creates. When you have a single problem like starvation, eliminating everyone whose genes are not adapted to dealing with starvation, and the only people that survive are the ones who have genes that allow them to adapt to starvation. And as Joe Goldstein and I have gotten into this field, we've been shocked to find out how little experimentation has been done in chronic starvation. There's been a huge amount of experimentation done in acute fasting. Claude Bernard, for example, of this institution, studied animals that were where you simply deprive them of food for 24 hours or 48 hours. That is acute fasting. And what happens when you take an animal that has stored energy in adipose tissue and you fast them, the first thing that happens is that the fatty acids are released from adipose tissue and they go to muscle where they spare glucose. Well, let me go back one step. The most important thing that must be maintained, and I'm sure Professor Changeux will agree with me, is the function of the brain. And the brain relies almost entirely on glucose. So in fasting, you must maintain the level of sugar, of glucose in the blood to maintain brain function. And the way that happens in acute fasting is that fatty acids are released from adipose tissue. They go to the liver, and although fatty acids cannot be converted directly to glucose, they supply energy that allows the liver to convert protein into glucose. But what happens in chronic starvation, like this little child? You see, there's no adipose tissue in chronic starvation. What happens if somebody has been subjected to chronic starvation so they lose all of their adipose tissue stores? How do they maintain their blood sugar if they are then deprived of food? And that's the question that Joe Goldstein and I are seeking to answer through studies of a particular hormone called ghrelin. Now, ghrelin is a new hormone, as hormones go. It was only discovered recently in 1999 in Japan by Kojima and Kanagawa. It's a peptide hormone. It has only 28 amino acids. It's produced in the stomach, but only in very rare cells in the stomach. 1% of the cells in the stomach produce ghrelin, and it's synthesized initially as pre-proghrelin, which has to be modified and cleaved by proteases to generate the 28 amino acid final form. And Kojima and Kanagawa made the really dramatic and surprising discovery that ghrelin is modified by O-acylation with octanoate, an 8-carbon fatty acid. And they showed that this 8-carbon fatty acid is essential for the biologic activity of ghrelin to release growth hormone, as I'll show you. So this is a unique modification. There's no other protein that we know of in nature that has an 8-carbon fatty acid attached to it in a covalent linkage. And as a result of this, there are two forms of ghrelin in the blood. There's ghrelin itself, and I use the word ghrelin to mean the 28 amino acid peptide with the octanoate attached. But also secreted into the blood is desacyl ghrelin. That is, some of the hormone is just the 28 amino acids without the fatty acid. And as far as we can tell, the desacyl ghrelin is inactive. And the final statement is that ghrelin, but not desacyl ghrelin, acts on the receptors in the brain to release growth hormone. So that's its function. Ghrelin goes to the brain and the hypothalamus, and it goes to the pituitary gland and releases ghrelin directly, and also stimulates certain releases growth hormone directly, and it also stimulates certain neurons that lead to growth hormone secretion. So here is the structure of ghrelin. It's the 28 amino acids, and this is the 8-carbon fatty acid attached to this serine, which is in the third position of the ghrelin molecule. And ghrelin is highly conserved in nature. It's found in fish, as far back as fish. It's in all vertebrates. And in every case, it has an octanoate residue attached to it. So we were attracted to ghrelin not because of its physiology, but because of the covalently attached fatty acid. Joe Goldstein and I have worked on other proteins that are modified by hydrophobic groups, for example, the prenyl transferases that are involved with RAS proteins and RAB proteins. And so when we read these papers and we realized that ghrelin has this unique modification, we were interested in the enzyme that attaches this octanoate residue to ghrelin. Now, the other thing that was known about ghrelin is that it undergoes a tremendous variation in the circulation of humans during a 24-hour cycle. So if you notice, what happens is this is the time when a human wakes up in the morning. The ghrelin level is relatively high. And then as soon as we eat breakfast, the ghrelin plummets. It gradually builds up during the morning until we eat lunch, and then it immediately declines. And then it gradually builds up before dinner, and then again, it declines. It builds up again in the night and then falls off a little bit until breakfast time, and again it falls. So, you know, we are just about here We're right before our dinner, so our ghrelin has been going up all afternoon. And this pattern suggested that maybe ghrelin is the hormone that makes us hungry before every meal. And that idea was supported by experiments in which ghrelin was injected directly into mice, rats, and humans, even humans. And when excess ghrelin is given, humans will eat more at a given meal than the controls. So, and the same is true for rodents. So when you give excess ghrelin, in pharmacologic studies, excess ghrelin increases appetite, increases food intake, and body weight in animals and humans. So everybody thought, including us, that that ghrelin is the thing that makes us hungry. And since we're trying to combat obesity, we thought maybe if we could identify the enzyme that attaches octanoate to ghrelin, and then we could develop inhibitors of that enzyme so that a human wouldn't be able to make ghrelin and therefore wouldn't be so hungry, and therefore we would not have so much problem with obesity. But then came the real disappointment, because the ghrelin gene was knocked out in mice. And also the ghrelin receptor, which is a G protein coupled receptor, that was also knocked out in mice. And the shock to the field was that knocking out ghrelin or the receptor did not decrease food intake or body weight. And in fact, if you take a mouse that cannot make ghrelin and you give it a high-calorie diet, the mouse will become just as obese as a mouse that can make ghrelin. And if you starve a mouse without ghrelin will become just as hungry as a mouse with ghrelin. So there's the paradox. Excess ghrelin stimulates feeding, but when you remove ghrelin, it doesn't decrease feeding. And so that raised the issue, what is the function of ghrelin? If you can take it away and have no effect on food intake, it must have some other function. And as I mentioned, our interest in this was in the enzyme, the potential enzyme that catalyzed this octanoylation reaction. And we had a very energetic graduate student who didn't want to work on the same things everybody else was working on in the laboratory, wanted his own project. And so we said, okay, why don't you identify this enzyme? Well, the enzyme presumably is expressed in the stomach because that's where ghrelin is made. But remember, ghrelin is only made in 1% of the cells in the mucosa of the stomach. So the enzyme is extremely rare. And so he spent a year grinding up the stomach and trying to do a direct assay of the enzyme activity and couldn't find any enzyme activity. And then he said, well, maybe we should do the cloning. And we all reasoned that the enzyme might be the member of a newly described family of enzymes called M-boats. M-boat stands for membrane-bound O-acyl transferases, M-boats. And a scientist in Germany had grouped these enzymes together and shown that there's a class of enzymes that transfers fatty acyl groups to lipids or proteins. So for example, the enzyme that makes cholesterol esters is an M-boat. The enzyme that transfers fatty acids to diacylglycerol to make triglycerides is an M-boat. And there's an enzyme wingless in the Wnt pathway is an M-boat that transfers a palmitate to proteins. So there were, and the human genome sequence revealed that there were 16 M-boats, and the function of only four of them was known. these had already, so there were 12 that had no function. And we decided that we would try to clone all the 16 M boats, make cDNAs for all 16 M boats, transfect them into cells in culture, and see if we could find one that would allow the cell to attach octanoate to ghrelin. So we transfected the potential acyl transferase and also a cDNA encoding pre-pro-ghrelin. And then we assayed to see whether the cell could actually make ghrelin. Now, this incredible student was able to obtain, by the polymerase chain reaction, was able to obtain 15 out of the 16 M boats. And he systematically transfected each one over about a one-year period, transfected each one into these cells, and none of them was able to catalyze this reaction. But he was not able to amplify the 16th M boat that was in the genome database. And he tried and tried and failed. And frankly, we told him not to continue, because what's the chance that the 16th one, I'm sure Professor Changzhou could tell you exactly what the statistical probability is, that you failed, the 15 of them don't work. What's the chance that the last one will work? You know, we didn't know. It could have been a problem with the assay. We didn't know that these cells, for example, that we were transfecting into, we didn't know that they could actually carry out the reaction, even if we gave them the enzyme, because maybe there was another factor required. Who knows why it wasn't working? So we said, you know, let's try another project. He said, no, I want to do the 16th one. So he did the 16th one. It turned out there was an error in the genome sequence, in the annotation of where the first exon in the gene was, and that's why he couldn't actually PCR it. So what he did was he basically synthesized the whole cDNA from oligonucleotides and assembled a whole cDNA. It took months of work. He transfected it into cells, and we were all shocked that this particular, the 16th one, actually worked. And that 16th one in the annotated genome database was called MBOAT4. And when the cDNA encoding this MBOAT4 was transfected into the cells that we were using, it produced octanoylated ghrelin. So, and then the question is this really the right enzyme? Well, one thing is it should be expressed in the same cells that make ghrelin. And this is, on the right, you see an in situ hybridization with the ghrelin, the goat. We call this enzyme ghrelin O-acyl transferase, which is the same as goat. And it's expressed in these scattered cells in the mucosa of the stomach, and it's the same cells that express ghrelin, as shown here. So we then set up a biochemical assay to measure goat activity in vitro, and basically he expressed the goat cDNA in insect cells, and then purified it and incubated it with recombinant ghrelin that had a histidine tag, incubated with tritiated octanoyl CoA, and then isolated the octanoylated ghrelin on a nickel column, and then counted it by scintillation counting. And what you can see here is that in the control, without any goat added, there was no transfer activity. When he put the goat wild-type protein into the assay, the goat transferred the octanoate to ghrelin. And this was a mutant of goat. This class of enzymes has a characteristic catalytic triad, and the key residue is this histidine 338. And when we changed that histidine to an alanine, we no longer got the transfer. So this enzyme can attach an octanoate to ghrelin, and it requires the catalytic residue of the enzyme. The next question was, what's the function? And so we did what everybody does these days, is to eliminate the gene for goat in mice. And when we did that, here's the plasma ghrelin level. This is, remember, octanoylated ghrelin. The ghrelin level in a wild-type mouse in the fed state, and this is when in the knockout mouse in the plasma. So we did indeed eliminate ghrelin from plasma, and this is the level goes up with fasting in the mouse, and again, there's no ghrelin in the plasma of the knockout animal. On the other hand, the desacyl form of ghrelin is still secreted, and so you see desacyl ghrelin is actually higher in the knockout animals, and it goes up with fasting. So when you eliminate goat, you eliminate octanoylated ghrelin, so this is the enzyme responsible for octanoylating ghrelin. So then we did the experiment that everybody has done, and we put the animals, we compared wild type and goat knockout animals when treated with a control diet or a high fat diet. And what you can see here is that on a high fat diet, the wild type animals gain weight, and so do the goat knockout animals. So this was the same exact result that people had gotten when they knocked out the gene for ghrelin. That is, you take ghrelin away and you don't have any reduction in obesity, the animals will still become obese. So what is the function of ghrelin? I'll tell you a little story about how we stumbled into this starvation. We thought that, you give an animal free access to food, it doesn't have to really struggle to get food, and yeah, sure, it doesn't need much drive for food. But if the true function of ghrelin is to stimulate appetite, then we thought, what happens if we put a wild-type mouse and a goat knockout mouse in the same cage, but only give them enough food for one? The prediction would be that the wild-type mouse would have more hunger and would therefore eat more, and the goat knockout guy, if the true selective function of ghrelin is to stimulate appetite, the goat knockout guy should waste away and the wild-type mouse should survive. But before we did that experiment, we said, well, let's just see what happens if we give each mouse, the wild-type and the goat knockout mouse, half the normal food. Keep them in separate cages, but give each one half the normal food. And that's when we made this astounding observation. And eventually we changed, instead of 50% calorie restriction, we went to 60% calorie restriction. So that, what that means is that each mouse is fed, the mice are placed in individual cages, and each mouse is fed 40% of its daily food intake for 7 to 9 days. And it's very important to know that food is supplied at 6 p.m. each day. And after a couple of days, the mice become so hungry that they consume this food within an hour. When the minute you put the food in the cage, they start eating, and they've eaten it all within an hour. And it's exactly the same in the wild-type mouse and the goat knockout mouse. And then we measured their blood glucose each day at 5:30. That's a 22 and a half hours after eating and 30 minutes before the next feeding. In other words, these mice eat their food so rapidly at 6 p.m. that they're basically fasting for the next 24 hours. And when we measure their blood sugar, it's after this prolonged fast. Now, here's what happened. If you looked at the body weight, this is a wild type, and the goat knockout animals had the same body weight when they were fed a normal diet. When they were calorie restricted, both the wild type and the goat knockout mice lost about 30% of their body weight over the next 3 to 4 days, and then it plateaued. If you looked at the total fat mass of the mouse, the total fat content of the mouse, in these particular mice, they start out with 8% of their body weight being triglyceride and adipose tissue. And that is maintained when they're in the fed state. But in the calorie-restricted state, they rapidly lose all this adipose tissue. And this is absolutely key. Their adipose tissue goes down from 8% to less than 2% of their body weight. So they've lost all of this adipose tissue. And the loss is exactly the same in the wild type and the goat knockout mice. But here's the first difference that we observe between these two animals, and that is in the blood sugar. In the wild-type mouse, when they're put on this diet, the wild-type mouse, the blood sugar goes down. This is the fasting blood sugar. It goes down, but then it stabilizes and stays above 40 milligrams per deciliter, which is kind of the borderline for normal behavior in a mouse. But in the goat knockout mice, the blood sugar never stabilizes. It keeps going down and down and down until, in many animals, it reaches as low as 10 to 15 milligrams per deciliter. At this point, the brain is not functioning. The animals are almost paralyzed, and we have to sacrifice them. So here's the first difference that anyone has ever seen between a wild type and a goat knockout animal or a ghrelin-deficient animal, and that is that the ghrelin-deficient animal is unable to maintain its blood sugar when subjected to this calorie-restricted diet. Now, it turns out that that phenomenon requires two things. It requires the fact that the animal has become depleted of adipose tissue, but it also requires that the animal has not had anything to eat for close to 24 hours. So here's the response to day-long starvation after 7 days of calorie restriction. So these animals have been calorie restricted for 7 days. And if you look at their blood sugar, even if we look at them at 9 o'clock in the morning, so that's about 16 hours after they ate their meal, the ghrelin, the goat knockout, and the wild type are pretty much the same. And the wild type guy is able to maintain their blood sugar all day long, even though they're not eating any food, whereas the goat knockout has this systematic decline in blood sugar. And then when they eat again at 6 o'clock, the blood sugar goes back to normal in both animals. If we look at the plasma ghrelin level, in the wild-type mouse, it starts out at a normal ghrelin level, but then the ghrelin climbs dramatically during the day when they're fasting, and then as soon as they eat food, the ghrelin level goes down. And of course, in the knockout mouse, there's no ghrelin in the plasma. If you look at desacyl ghrelin, it goes up to the same degree in the wild type and knockout mouse, and then it goes down after feeding. And here's the important thing. In the wild type mouse, plasma growth hormone goes up progressively during the day. And as I'll show you, it is this increase in the growth hormone that is maintaining their blood sugar. And then, again, it declines in parallel with the ghrelin when they eat food. This growth hormone increase does not occur in the goat minus animals. So ghrelin is necessary in order for this big increase in growth hormone to occur during fasting in these calorie-restricted animals. Now, the question arose as to whether this is all really due to the ghrelin deficiency, or is it some other activity of goat that's required? So we obtained some ghrelin knockout mice, And we see the same thing. You take a ghrelin knockout mouse, you put it on calorie restriction for 7 days, and then you let it fast, and again, the blood sugar goes down. The only difference between the ghrelin knockout and the goat knockout is that in the ghrelin knockout, the desacyl ghrelin doesn't go up. And of course, the growth hormone doesn't go up, just like in the goat knockout. So this is really, this hypoglycemia is due to the loss of ghrelin. The question then is, can we prevent it by giving back ghrelin? So we took an osmotic mini pump and loaded it either with ghrelin or with growth hormone at these doses. And we started the infusion 3 days before doing the calorie restriction. And the result, these are all of the animals here are goat knockout animals. And when they were given saline, their blood sugar gradually declined over the 7 days. But when they were given ghrelin, that decline was prevented, and they had the same blood sugar as normals. We measured the plasma growth hormone level, and again, in the goat knockout guys, growth hormone was low, but when we maintained ghrelin, growth hormone went up. So ghrelin can prevent this hypoglycemia. Is the only requirement that ghrelin stimulate growth hormone? Well, to test that, we gave the animals, instead of giving them ghrelin, we gave them growth hormone directly. And again, the growth hormone itself was able to prevent hypoglycemia in these goat minus animals. And of course, the growth hormone animals had high growth hormone. So ghrelin maintains blood sugar in a starved animal, and it does so by stimulating growth hormone. So then the question is, how does growth hormone maintain the blood glucose level during starvation? And what this experiment is we're trying to measure the total body synthetic rate of glucose. We're trying to measure glucose production at a whole body level. And one way of doing that is to infuse tritiated, radiolabeled glucose into the blood at a consistent rate to maintain a steady, specific activity of the glucose in the blood. That is a certain number of counts per minute of tritiated glucose divided by the total glucose. When we did that, this is now after 7 days, the goat minus guys have a low blood sugar, the wild type animals have a normal blood sugar. We were able to maintain a constant level of tritiated radioactivity in the blood. When we did that, what we found was that the specific activity of the glucose was much higher. In other words, there were more counts per minute per microgram of glucose in the goat minus guys than in the wild type. And that what that means is that the goat minus guys were not pouring out as much unlabeled glucose into their blood. So that's why the specific activity was higher. In these animals, the radioactivity was being diluted by the glucose that was being produced. Here, the dilution was much less, and you can use that to calculate the glucose production rate, and the glucose production rate in the goat minus guys is about half of what it is in the wild type. So the reason these animals are hypoglycemic is because they're not producing as much glucose. This slide illustrates what is called the Cori cycle of glucose metabolism. It begins in the liver. The liver secretes glucose into the blood. The glucose is taken up by muscle. It undergoes glycolysis to the 3-carbon lactate. Lactate is released from the muscle. It goes back to the liver and gets resynthesized into glucose. This is not an efficient process because it takes glucose oxidation by glycolysis only generates two ATP molecules, whereas the conversion of lactate back to glucose requires six ATPs. Some of the glucose that is metabolized in muscle is transaminated and released as the amino acid alanine, which can also contribute to gluconeogenesis in the liver. So the important point is that you need energy to drive this cycle. And the question was, can we, first of all, what happens to the levels of these intermediates? So here again is a 24-hour, we're following these animals for 24 hours after they've been calorie restricted. And in the wild type guys, the glucose is maintained. In the goat knockouts, the glucose goes down. They both go up when they're fed. Here's the plasma lactate level. It starts out in the morning when the glucoses are the same, the lactates are the same. But then the plasma lactate level goes down in the goat knockout animal. Here are plasma-free fatty acids. Now, if you take an animal that has normal adipose tissue and you fast them for 24 hours, plasma-free fatty acids actually go up. But in these animals that have no adipose tissue, plasma-free fatty acids go down during the day because they have no adipose tissue to release fatty acids. And the same thing is true with ketone bodies, which are metabolites of fatty acids. They go down during the day. Plasma insulin, of course, is basically undetectable because the blood sugar is falling. And plasma glucagon, the hormone that stimulates glucose production in the liver, is elevated, and it only goes down after feeding. But notice that the level is just as high in the wild type as it is, in the knockout, as it is in the wild type. And I'm not going to show you the data, but glucagon acts on the liver to raise messenger RNAs for enzymes that produce glucose. And all of those messenger RNAs are very high, both in the wild type and the goat knockout. So the animal is responding appropriately. It has no insulin, and it has very high glucagon, which ought to be driving glucose production. But we hypothesize that the deficiency of lactate is what is limiting the production. So let me just skip this slide. It's not important. So the model now is that this is a syndrome that occurs when you have no adipose tissue and you're subjected to a fast. And to test that hypothesis, we took one group of mice, of wild-type mice and of goat-minus mice, and we put them on a high-fat diet for several weeks before we did the experiment. So these mice were forced to gain weight and adipose tissue. So if you look at the fat mass, in the wild-type mice, they're about 8% body fat. We doubled the body fat to 16% by having fed them this high-fat diet. And exactly the same thing happened in the goat knockout. So the goat knockout guys and the wild-type guys both have either a normal amount of body fat or they're obese before you start the experiment. And then we fast them for different days. And again, what you see here is that, this is the free fatty acids. First of all, look at the fat mass. When they're given the chow diet, the fat mass goes down in wild type, goes down in the goat minus. When they've got this much fat to begin with, it takes much longer to get to this 2% threshold because they've started out with so much more body fat. Now, if you look at the free fatty acids in the plasma, again, it parallels the loss of body fat. In both in the wild type and in the goat knockout, free fatty acids go down in plasma, but when the animals have been pre-fed, the fatty acids in plasma are maintained for a much longer time. Now, this is the key experiment, the blood glucose. In the wild-type animals, it doesn't really matter whether they've been, with the low body weight, they maintain their blood sugar throughout. In the goat knockout guys, if they do not have excess fat to begin with, they become hypoglycemic after 7 or 8 days, as we have seen all consistently. But if they've had more adipose tissue to begin with, it takes twice as long for them. They don't become hypoglycemic until 12 to 14 days. So the more adipose tissue you start out with, the more resistant you are to this hypoglycemia, which says that it's really the depletion of adipose tissue that's causing this problem. Now the question is, can we reverse this hypoglycemia by restoring lactate or alanine or fatty acids? And so here is the experiment. We took goat minus animals. And as you see, during the day, they become hypoglycemic. But if we inject lactate into them intraperitoneally here, as indicated by these arrows, we maintain the blood sugar. We can do the same thing with alanine, which can be converted to glucose. Here's the most interesting one. We used octanoate. This has nothing to do with ghrelin and the fact that ghrelin has octanoate. We used octanoate because it's a more soluble form of fatty acids and it's easier to inject this 8-carbon fatty acid than longer chain ones. And just 2 injections of octanoate were able to maintain the blood sugar in the goat minus guys. So if you give them back the substrate, lactate, or if you give them back this something that they can use for energy to make new glucose, on either case, you restore the blood sugar. So what we believe is then that during starvation, during this period of starvation, when you have no adipose tissue, somehow growth hormone allows this cycle to work, whereas if you don't have ghrelin and you can't increase your growth hormone, the lactate production is diminished, and as a result, the liver can't make sufficient glucose to keep the brain alive. So we believe that the essential function of ghrelin is to maintain blood sugar in times of famine by stimulating growth hormone release. Now, this is all in mice. The question is, does it have any relevance to humans? This is a human being with a condition called anorexia nervosa. These people, for some totally unexplained reason, just stop eating. And they lose, as you see here, they've lost every ounce of adipose tissue. So they're like our calorie-restricted mice. And what's known about these people is that they have very high blood levels of ghrelin and growth hormone. So the and they can, you know, they do eventually die, some of them, from hypoglycemia, but they're able to maintain this state for a very long time without, as long as we believe, as long as they can make ghrelin and growth hormone. So we believe that the same thing, and growth hormone and ghrelin and growth hormone have also been shown to be elevated in humans with cachexia from cancer, people who have lost all their body fat. Anytime you lose all your body fat, you get this big increase in ghrelin and growth hormone, both in humans and in mice. So we believe that the thing that's keeping this lady alive is her ghrelin. All right, I want to close by returning to something that I had to leave out on the last lecture. Everything that I've covered in these lectures has been done in a partnership with another scientist, Joe Goldstein, and he and I have been working together since 1971, which is 40 years. And in fact, we think that this is the longest scientific partnership, at least in biology, that we know about. And I just want to point out that we had very different backgrounds, okay? So Joe Goldstein was born in this tiny town of Sumter, South Carolina, and he stayed there until he went to college. I don't know what the an analogous town in France would be. It's some place that has 3,000 people and is totally remote from any intellectual stimulation whatsoever. But that's Sumter, South Carolina. How he could grow up there, I have no idea, but and become an intellect. On the other hand, I'm much more typical. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and raised in Philadelphia, in a city that had 2,000 times more people in it than Sumter, South Carolina. Joe went to a southern university, Washington and Lee University, where he was an honor student. This Phi Beta Kappa is the Student Honor Society. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, which is an Ivy League school in the city of Philadelphia. I was also an honor student. Then Joe went to this crazy medical school, Southwestern Medical School. It was one of the newest, youngest medical schools in the country. It was founded only in 1943, and Joe was at the top of his class. I went to the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, which is America's oldest, and I know you'll laugh at me when I say this is old, but it was founded in 1765. Not old by French standards, but old by American standards. And I also was a good student. So how did we come together? Well, we met. We were both accepted for a residency in medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. That's one of the Harvard hospitals. It was a very difficult residency to get. You had to be a very top student. And I was delighted to be accepted. And I went there, and I didn't, to be honest, I didn't understand why they had accepted some guy from Sumter, South Carolina, who went to this new medical school that no one ever heard of. I thought they made a mistake. I couldn't understand it at all until I met Joe Goldstein. And within a very short time, it was clear that he knew more medicine than anybody else, certainly more than any of the other residents and more than half of the faculty. So we became very good friends, and we shared an interest. We both liked to play duplicate bridge, and in the rare days, evenings that we had off from our hospital work, we would go to these bridge tournaments. I should tell you, we didn't do very well, but it was fun. And then we both were accepted at the National Institutes of Health, and I've already met several people here who spent time at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of Washington. Joe worked with Marshall Nirenberg, who was who received the Nobel Prize for figuring out the genetic code. I worked with Earl Statman, who was the great enzymologist of the NIH, one of the founders of the field of enzyme regulation, who, by the way, studied here at the Pasteur Institute. And then Joe went to the University of Washington for another fellowship in genetics. And I came directly to UT Southwestern. Now, some of you who were at an earlier lecture will know that while we were at NIH, we saw these two children with very high cholesterol levels, and we wanted to understand what kind of gene mutation would cause such high cholesterol. And Joe had been a student at Southwestern, so he convinced me to go there. The big difficulty was convincing my wife. She for us, Dallas, Texas, was the end of the world. I don't think you have a place like that in France. I can't give you a reference, but it was considered to be a very backward place back in the 1970s. And I pay tremendous tribute to my wife, Alice, for agreeing to come with me to Dallas, Texas, especially because my other job offer was in San Francisco at the University of California, rather beautiful city. And so, she agreed, but I promised her it would only be for 1 year. And that was in 1971. And but by 1972, Joe had come back to Dallas, and we began our collaboration as assistant professors, a collaboration that has lasted 40 years. And this is a picture of us when we met back in 1966, when we were very young. And it was only a short time after that we did our most crucial experiments. So these pictures illustrate what happens to a 40-year partnership. First, the meeting in 1976, 1974, a picture of us in the lab, 1985, the prize, the Nobel Prize. And in 2012, we're a lot different than we were, but we're still doing science. Now, I want to point out that partnerships in science are not rare. This is a list of Nobel Prize-winning partnerships in biomedical science, so it doesn't include Pierre and Marie Curie, for example. But this is in biomedical science, and when you look at it, it's really sort of shocking how many Nobel Prizes have been given to work that has been shared by two people. This is not the condition where two people get a Nobel Prize because one contributed one thing and the other contributed another. I'm talking about where the two people did the key experiments together. And our partnership of 40 years, we've recently surpassed the Coreys, who were great, great biochemists, and Stein and Moore, and Cournon and Richards, so many. And now I want to point out, of course, the productivity is not necessarily related to the time. So Watson and Crick did much more in 2 years than we did in 40. But I think it's also true of Jacob and Monod. But I want to point out one of the negative things about work. Partnerships are fantastic. For any student here, any young person, I highly recommend it as a way of sharing a scientific experience and sharing the joy of, you know, when you travel. Isn't it nice to have a companion to travel with, to share the joys of finding a new place? Well, it's the same thing when you make a new discovery. Having a partner to share it with is a wonderful experience. But I want to point out the negatives, okay? I want to point out these two people from the Pasteur Institute, okay? And I want you to remember their names, okay? It's François Jacob and Jacques Monod. Now I want to show you an article about in the New York Times in 2003 about the discovery of RNA. And if you can read that, at a meeting in Cambridge, England, Dr. Crick and his colleague, Signe Brenner, were comparing notes on protein synthesis problem with their French colleague, François Monod. So that is the danger of a partnership. You tend to lose your individual identity. I want to finish these four lectures going back to the quotation that I started with at the beginning. Claude Bernard, one of the pillars of the Collège de France, was really the person who called attention to the fact that our bodies are adapted to maintain a constant internal constitution when the external environment changes dramatically. And everything I've talked about in all four lectures has to do with exactly that. That's the regulatory system that is really the sort of philosophical underpinning of everything Joe and I have done. This these studies on starvation are an exact example of that. What we're studying is how the body can maintain a constant level of glucose in the blood when there's nothing coming in from the outside. And that adaptability of the body to the changing external environment, that's what keeps us alive. That also is what underlies most of the diseases, all of the diseases that we suffer from, unless they're purely genetic. And even purely genetic diseases are very much associated with the environment. So it's this constant interplay between the external environment and our internal biochemistry that is, for Joe and me, has been the fun of these 40 years. And with that, I want to thank everyone again. Some of you have been to all four of these lectures. I thank you for your patience, and I appreciate it very much. And I definitely appreciate the privilege of being here in Paris for the last 4 weeks. Thank you.